Welcome to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cass. Thanks for joining us. News coverage since Sunday has been dominated by the tragedy in Orlando, Florida. A few minutes after 2 a.m., a gunman opened fire in Pulse, a gay nightclub, and when it was over, several hours later, 49 people were dead and 53 wounded. The gunman, 29-year-old Omar Mateen, was shot and killed by police. This is the highest death toll of any mass shooting in U.S. history. As police continue to investigate, more details about Mateen have emerged. The FBI investigated him twice, looking at possible connections to terrorist organizations. While Orlando police stated that Mateen pledged his loyalty to the Islamic State during a 911 call made inside the club, President Obama said yesterday there was no evidence that the shooting was part of a larger terrorist plot. Mateen's ex-wife told reporters he was abusive and, quote, mentally unstable and mentally ill, end quote. The media is also reporting today that Mateen may have been a regular patron of the club prior to the shooting. This hour we'll discuss the fact and fiction surrounding mental illness and violence, including whether a history of mental illness can be used to predict mass shootings. We'll also talk about the profile of mass shooters in the United States and what steps can be taken to prevent gun deaths. Our guest today is Dr. Jonathan Metzl, a professor of psychiatry and sociology at Vanderbilt University. He's director of the school's Center for Medicine, Health, and Society. Dr. Metzl also is research director for the Safe Tennessee Project, an organization that views gun violence as a public health issue. Welcome to Midday, Dr. Metzl.
Hello, I'm honored to be here.
We're very, very glad to have you. As someone who studies mass shootings, what was your reaction when you heard about the news in Orlando?
Well, I think like many people, I don't think it really matters if you're somebody who studies mass violence or not. There's just a level of shock and trauma, really national trauma, that follows mass shootings. And I think part of that is that mass shootings very often happen. Part of the shock and horror of them is that they happen in places that are seemingly safe sanctuaries for people. So we see a mass shooting in a movie theater, a mass shooting in a children's school, a mass shooting here in a nightclub that itself was a form of sanctuary. And so I think part of the horror of mass shootings is this dynamic in which places that seemingly are safe havens for different kinds of people become sites of death. And I think in a way it's a very human response that even experts in this field have, which is a sense of shock and horror, and also a very disseminated sense of unsafety. I think there's a general sense that if a shooting can happen there, and there being a place of safety, that it can happen everywhere. And so people themselves almost share empathically in the trauma, but also themselves feeling more on edge. I think that people respond to that differently, but I do think that sense of safety is breached for all of us.
Well, and of course, I think another factor that breaches a sense of safety this week is the massive death toll and injury toll. The shooting in Orlando with 49 victims, 53 injured, is the deadliest mass shooting in U.S. history. So do you worry that without some type of major intervention, mass shootings will just keep escalating?
Well, I do think that there are various dynamics at play, and certainly the death toll is just unthinkable. 100 people shot, at least that we know of, massive death. I do think that there is a kind of it's not even a copycat phenomenon, because as somebody who studies the history of mass shootings, I know that, for example, earlier versions of mass shootings, obviously the death count was much lower. And I do think that it's almost like every mass shooting attempts to top the one before it. And so I don't think it's an accident that we see increasing death tolls from mass shootings. And in part, it's just because, just to put it frankly, it's harder to get on the news in a way that we've become so numb almost to the specter of multiple people getting shot by strangers, that I think that people who really want to achieve the kind of notoriety that we see, in Orlando, but before that in so many other places, almost have to top the mass shooter before them. So partially, I think the issue is about what it takes, you know, the kind of, it's all of us. It's our own sense of shock. It's the media, factors like that. But I don't think that it's accidental that shootings become worse and worse. And I certainly think that if history is a guide, that trend will continue if we don't do something about it.
Is there a profile that works of people who commit mass shootings?
Well, I mean, again, that's a very loaded question. One that, of course, we all want the answer to. And I think, you know, part of what's behind a question like that is the question of how can we profile somebody and predict what they're going to do. And
prevent it, yeah, absolutely.
Prevent it, I'm sorry. And so partially I think that the answer to that question is there are certain trends we see, of course, in people who commit acts of mass violence like this. I think that there have been research that shows that, you know, I think I'm not going to be on the show and say that mental symptoms are not important. Certainly we see roughly 60% of mass shooters, according to some studies, have had some history of some kind of symptoms like delusions or hallucinations or paranoia, factors like that. I think where we get into trouble is to say, therefore, we have the profile and that's going to help us predict who's going to commit the next mass shooting. So, I mean, certainly we can think demographically, there's often a gender component. Mass shootings of this nature are often kind of youngish, disaffected men. Unlike this shooting, they're often youngish, disaffected white men. But I think that, you know, there's a history of grievance. There are many other factors. But I guess the other point I want to make is that even though it's very important to profile mass shooters, we also have to keep in mind that there's a difference between understanding kind of retrospectively, oh, there was that psychology, and thinking that that profile will help us predict the next mass shooting. And I think that's where we get into trouble when we talk about mental illness.
So, I mean, are you essentially saying that none of it is predictable?
No. I certainly think that many things are predictable. And certainly I think, you know, no. So I don't want to say that we shouldn't try to predict mass shootings. But I would also say that I think that prevention is probably where we're going to get the most kind of bang for our buck in a particular way. And the reason I say that is because I think we're talking about two categories here. One category is mass shootings, and another category is just overall gun death in the United States. Gun death itself is, there are factors that you can kind of predict. So things like substance abuse, access to firearms, past histories of violence, factors like that. Those factors are very closely aligned, I think, with predicting who's going to go on to commit a violent act in the future. Mass shootings themselves are so statistically rare. They happen kind of out of the blue. They're very, very hard to predict. And in a way, they're very hard to prevent, particularly in a culture where it's easy to access firearms.
That's psychiatrist and sociologist Jonathan Metzl of Vanderbilt University here on Midday on WYPR. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking about mass shootings and how we should understand them and what might be a way to prevent them. We're happy to take your questions or comments. You can send us an email at midday@wypr.org, or you can call us at 410-662-8780. I want to make sure that I'm sort of following your point. Are you basically saying that many of the factors that show up in the ordinary play of gun violence in America are the same factors that show up in the mass shootings that
right,
grab
right.
bigger
I'm sorry
headlines?
I'm sorry if I wasn't clear about that. So I guess first, I guess I was thinking in part as a psychiatrist, and
that's why we invited you.
No, exactly. And from that angle, I would say that psychiatrists see literally thousands of people over the course of a month or a year who fit the profile of what we later say, oh gosh, that person's a mass shooter. So psychiatrists will see many, many, many patients who are angry, hostile, aggrieved, oftentimes gun owning, factors like that. And there's no diagnosis that a psychiatrist can use that says, of these thousands of people, this one person is going to go on to commit a violent act, and everybody else isn't going to. And it's not like there's nothing in the diagnostic and statistic manual about schizophrenia or depression or any other diagnosis where killing somebody else or shooting somebody else is a symptom. And so part of the issue is, of course, we need these profiles to understand what's going on with mass shooters. Where we get into trouble, I think, is then we say, and therefore what we're going to do is we're going to use that profile, and then psychiatrists are going to be able to pick out this kind of needle in a haystack. And I certainly think I felt a lot of almost empathy when I was reading about the FBI, for example, because I wanted to know how many other people were they profiling in Orlando, for example. And it's really just a selection issue. We don't have the tools to know which person that fits this profile, even the highest risk profile, is going to go on to commit a violent act. In psychiatry, when we think about violence, for example, we think about one of the cardinal symptoms we've always thought is what's called command hallucinations, the idea that people are hearing voices telling them to go harm somebody else. And even among patients who have command hallucinations, most of those patients, over 95%, are able to resist the urge to go hurt somebody. And so in a way, you can't really just hospitalize every single person or surveil every single person who has that symptom. What you can do is say if people meet certain high-risk criteria, you might want to make it harder for them to get an assault rifle, for example, or other factors like that. So you can prevent, but you can't predict which exact person is going to go on to commit a violent act.
Of course, there is an urge, and although we did not know when we asked you to speak with us that we would be speaking 2 days after such a horrible tragedy, there's always an urge to understand what's going on. And I mean, a lot of people, it seems reasonable that people who commit atrocities of this magnitude are mentally ill, because who else would do it?
Absolutely. It's a mode of processing. I'm very supportive of that. I probably do it myself. I think that in a way, mental illness becomes a kind of lingua franca for us processing a seemingly unhuman, uncivilized act. Who would go and shoot people enjoying themselves? Who would shoot children? Who would shoot moviegoers? And so part of the issue when we have, in a way, our response to this goes in phases, and our first phase often is to jump to the immediate answer. And so mental illness it's very understandable. And again, I also think it's understandable because I think that there are symptoms that are in the histories of a lot of mass shooters. I think, again, where we get into trouble is after the shock has worn off and after we've had the immediate answer, oh my gosh, it's mental illness, that's the reason, or oh my gosh, in this case, it's terrorism, that's the one reason. But what we find as we start to unpack the histories of mass shootings, and certainly this seems to be the case in Orlando, we learn that actually the immediate moniker that we've ascribed, mental illness, or in this case, terrorism, is actually a bit more complicated, that it has to do with a bunch of other factors. And so when I talk to, for example, popular audiences about this issue, I say it's not like in any way people who do what I do deny that there are mental symptoms that go into people's decision to commit cold-blooded murder. But I don't think that we can say, therefore, that's the one causal factor, that mental illness caused the shooting, because doing so makes us overlook a bunch of other factors about what's going on in their life. How easy did they get their firearms, access to firearms? Were they abusing substances? A bunch of other issues that I think are equally causal. And we lose that when we just say, this is the one thing that caused this horrific act.
We need to take a quick break here. When we come back, we'll continue this conversation with Dr. Jonathan Metzl about mass shootings, what's behind them, how we can be smarter about trying to head them off. You can join our conversation. What is your reaction to the coverage of the Orlando shooting? Has the number of mass shootings in recent history made you feel numb to their impact? You can join the conversation. Call us at 410-662-8780 or send us an email at midday@wypr.org. I'm Sheila Cast. Stay with us. Welcome back to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cast. In the wake of mass shootings, politicians and pundits often point a finger at our nation's beleaguered mental health system. But is mental illness the culprit? Would increasing access to mental health treatment prevent future mass shootings? My guest today is Dr. Jonathan Metzl, a psychiatrist and sociologist at Vanderbilt University in Nashville, Tennessee. He argues that this blame is misplaced and distracts from pursuit of a more effective way to prevent gun violence, that is, gun control. What are your thoughts on this? Do you think that conversations about mental illness distract people from considering other potential methods of preventing mass violence? You can call us at 410-662-8780 or send us an email at midday@wypr.org. One thing I should have sort of defined early on, Dr. Metzl, the Washington Post reported last year that the U.S. averages about one mass shooting a day. They use data that define a mass shooting as any single incident in which at least four people are shot, including the gunman. Other definitions count only incidents where there are three or more fatalities. How do you define a mass shooting?
Well, I think there's been a broadening of the definition recently, and I think the reason that is because we were only counting the kind of spectacular innocent victim kinds of mass shootings, but we were not looking at many other instances where four or more people were killed in, for example, low-income areas and poor areas. In a way, we were saying that's not a mass shooting. I think rightly there was a broadening to say actually those issues are mass shootings as well, even though they don't get the same media attention. And I think also they don't fit the same dynamic people seem to feel. But I do think that broadening the definition of a mass shooting has been of benefit to understanding really the scourge of mass violence and gun violence in this country.
Carla has called us from Baltimore. Carla, welcome to Midday.
Hi. Actually, my name is Paula.
Paula, I'm sorry.
Okay.
I misheard it.
I have
welcome.
Bipolar disorder, and I'm also gay, and I feel I mean, like the rest of the country, I feel devastated by what happened. And when a mass murder happens, it just causes a lot of dread in me for another reason, and that's because of I have bipolar disorder, and I'm not violent. I've never been violent. I have had absolutely no desire ever to be violent. And I do have serious mental illness, and I know a lot of people who do. People who have schizophrenia, who have no desire to be violent, and I really feel, even if nobody says anything directly to me, like hearing radio shows and the TV and, this murderer's wife diagnosed him with bipolar disorder, I don't know if she's even qualified to diagnose him. And,
It must be both frustrating and kind of scary.
Yeah, it really is. And I have had people say things to me like, so when you go off your medication, do you get violent? And, I never go off my medication anyway, but if I did, I don't get violent. And
but it's also not something that you should have to explain to someone. Paula, I appreciate your calling us and giving us your perspective on this. Dr. Metzl, what goes through your mind when you hear Paula's comment?
Absolutely. Well, a number of things. I think, again, this is the problem that we fall into when we take individual actions and then blame an entire group of people, very often an entire stigmatized group of people. And I think this is particularly problematic in the case of mental illness for a couple of reasons. One, as we just heard, is that there's already tremendous stigma against people with mental illness as being ticking time bombs. I think that the caller articulated that very well. And particularly in the case of gun violence, I think we need to be very wary of those stigmatizations for a couple of reasons. One is that if you look at gun violence in the United States, people diagnosed with mental illness are less likely than the national average, less likely than sane people to attack other people or to shoot other people. And part of the reason is if you look at it as an aggregate group, people with mental illness, very often their symptoms cause them to withdraw from society, or they have what, you know, low energy or negative symptoms and schizophrenia. And so some researchers argue that mental illness actually is protective against attacking other people. I can't say that enough. People with mental illness, first of all, are less likely to attack other people than sane people. And the other part is that people with mental illness are far, far more likely to be victims of violence rather than perpetrators of violence. And so in a way, they become targets, and particularly if people with mental illness inhabit several stigmatized groups, like the caller just said, not just mental illness, but also sexual identity or ethnicity, race, factors like that. And so in a way, what we're doing is we're jumping to this assumption about all people with mental illness, and it really upends what really happens in the real world.
That's Dr. Jonathan Metzl, professor of psychiatry and sociology at Vanderbilt University, here on Midday on WIPR. I'm Sheila Kast. You can be part of this conversation. As Paula was, you can send us an email at midday@wypr.org, or you can phone us 410-662-8780. Paula's call, I think, reminds me and points out the value of some research that was published this month. Researchers at the Bloomberg School of Public Health published their study of how the news media covers stories involving mental illness. I spoke with Beth McGinty, assistant professor in the Johns Hopkins Departments of Health Policy and Management and Mental Health at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health.
This study looks at news coverage in a group of high circulation and high viewership print and television news sources. And our goal was really to see whether that coverage has changed and what the news media has focused on. And what we found was that there's been very little change in news media coverage of mental illness over the past two decades, and that a large proportion of that news coverage focuses on violence. Like with any topic, the news media focuses on a variety of different issues within the overall topic of mental illness, ranging from things like treatment to problems faced by this population like homelessness and criminal justice involvement. And more than half of news coverage about mental illness focuses on violence, either interpersonal violence toward others or self-directed violence, suicide.
How often did the coverage that you monitored mention treatment for mental illness, including the possibility of recovery?
So a relatively large proportion of news stories mentioned any type of treatment, almost half, 47% of news stories mentioned any sort of treatment at all, which could have been as simple as alluding to a clinic or a doctor's visit in the news story. That would have been coded as mentioning treatment. However, only 14% of news stories mentioned the potential for successful treatment for and recovery from mental illness. And that's really concerning, given that mental illness is a treatable condition, and we know from prior research that news media messages about successful treatment and recovery actually have the potential to decrease stigma.
That was Beth McGinty of the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health and the Department of Health Policy and Management. Jonathan Metzl, what do you see as the impact on society when about half of news stories about mental illness focus on violence and very few news stories mention the possibility of recovery?
Well, I think the point was very well made just now. I think that, in a way, none of us want to get into the situation of saying we shouldn't talk about mental illness. There is a mental health crisis in this country. We do need more resources for mental health care. I think that's very important, and I think that the media plays a very large role in that. unfortunately, the media by nature is very sensationalistic for the most part, and I'm part of that as well. It just the nature of the beast in a particular way. But in a way, what we hear are the media pays attention to mental illness at times like these, and so in a way, what gets reported and skewed and overreported are questions about these questions of violence, and what we don't look at are more broader questions about mental health. Health systems, the need for resources in the system, factors like that. And so partially it's just when we hear about mental illness in the news, as in addition to what's actually in the stories. And in a way, we might say that about guns as well. I mean, we don't, until recently, it's changing now, but until recently, we only talked about guns in the aftermath of mass shootings. And what that kind of, the message was that most gun death really, what we need to do is address mass shootings in this country, but we have 35, 36,000 gun deaths a year in the country. So like mental illness, gun death is an everyday issue, and I think we need ongoing coverage about gun issues as well as about mental illness.
We have a call from Pete calling us from Baltimore. Pete, welcome to Midday.
Hi, am I on?
Yes, you are. You're on the air, Pete.
Well, I'm glad to hear the doctor refer to so many other really obvious factors that cause people to be violent. I think the mental illness thing is really pretty much a red herring. I think that the real thing is that we're afraid to look in the mirror. We need to look at our culture, and in particular, if there's one thing that qualifies a person to end up as a shooter, it's that they're male. And we have a really terrible way of socializing all of us in general in terms of being supportive and in terms of really communicating with each other. But it's absolutely the worst with men. And it's an easy way out. It's easy to kind of not look at how we actually treat each other day to day in our institutions. So I guess that's about it.
Pete, I appreciate your calling. And we, Dr. Metzl, we had mentioned before that most shooters, especially in mass shootings, are male. And you had made the point that that doesn't mean you can assume that every male is about to pull the trigger. So, right. What would you tell Pete? I mean, what can we do with this information about? Males being more likely to shoot.
I teach a class called The Politics of Masculinity at Vanderbilt. It's one of the classes I teach, and I certainly do make the point that if we just limited guns to men in this country, our rates of mass shooting would certainly go down. I do think that there are masculinity factors that
Wait a minute. To men.
Yeah. I don't think it's happenstance. There are also higher rates of gun ownership for men. And certainly rates of other kinds of gun death, like gun suicide, are higher in men. And so I do think that there is a kind of gendered coding of the firearm itself that's a broader problem than mass shootings. Again, we were talking about the demographics before, so this certainly plays out in mass shootings. But I also think this is something to be concerned about because, the NRA, for example, is trying to broaden that market in a way. And so now they're trying to sell guns for, on campuses to stop sexual assaults and other factors like that. And so they're trying to kind of broaden the gendered appeal of firearms, I would say. But I do think that in a way there is a kind of there's the gun crisis story that sometimes intersects with this story about kind of the crisis of masculinity. And I guess I'm just thinking that it's not just about men. There's nothing kind of biological about men that they have to go commit mass shootings. But I guess I'm just, in my mind, I'm thinking about the more recent mass shootings that we've had, and particularly in relation to questions of gender and mental illness. And so you were coming up, for example, on the one-year anniversary of the Charleston shooting in a couple of days here. Another mass shooting that fits a similar demographic to what we were talking about, a disaffected male who had certain kinds of ideologies. In this case, it was not just maybe being unstable by some traditional notion, but also racism, obviously. And so I think that also it complicates this question that we're talking about today, which is what is mental illness? And I think, in a way, if you think about the Charleston issue, yes, it was gender, and yes, maybe there were some mental mental symptoms, but if you had asked me what was the mental illness in the Charleston shooting, it was racism in a way. And I think as we progress with understanding or with Orlando, I mean, I haven't heard anybody say that homophobia was a mental illness. But I do think that that's part of the drive about what's going on in this case. And I think we need to look not just at traditional mental illnesses, but at traditional stigmatizations and maybe think about them as hate crimes as well.
So essentially a point at which religious extremism becomes a form of mental illness?
Well, again, I mean, psychiatrists get in trouble when they say everything is a mental illness and we need to diagnose everything. And certainly, you know, this question of treatment becomes more complicated. But I would just say that a lot of times when we say, oh, gosh, this is, I mean, if you think about what a traditional mental illness is, it's depression or schizophrenia or anxiety. And as I said before, those factors are statistically unrelated for the most part to gun crime. But when you combine people who maybe, you know, have some kinds of mental symptoms, but then you combine other factors like racism or Islamophobia or homophobia to the mix, I do think that that's where the volatility sometimes comes from in people who are at risk. My point is that when we say it's just mental illness, it's just schizophrenia, it's just depression, we in a way shave off those other major factors like racism and like homophobia that I think are, to my mind, at least sociologically speaking, mental illnesses as well, and are equally causal in thinking about this kind of gun violence.
Earlier in our conversation, you've pointed out that we shouldn't think of mass shootings without also thinking of the daily drumbeat of gun violence or violence in our country. And it seems to me that, and I in fact read an analysis in the Washington Post that says one thing we may need also to connect now is an overlap between mass shootings and acts of terror, which we didn't used to think of as in the same category, but the San Bernardino shooting, obviously, and this one raise that question too.
Right. Again, I think that the issue is the same in a particular way, which is what, you know, as I mentioned before, we have about 35,000-36,000 gun deaths a year in this country. Sadly and unfortunately, the number of people who die in everyday gun violence is far, far in excess to the people number of people who die in mass shootings. But everyday violence doesn't get the same kinds of media coverage. And I do think that there are common sense prevention issues that we can take that I think will reduce that number. We'll save more people, I think, in this country if we think about more common sense solutions. In a way, I'm part of a project called the Safe Tennessee Project. In our project, we have people from all across the spectrum, pro-gun people, anti-gun people, et cetera, trying to find some kind of middle ground. And the kind of interventions that we're looking at don't infringe on anybody's Second Amendment rights. We're not trying to go take away anybody's gun.
I'm going to interrupt you because we need to take a short break, and I really want to talk about common sense solutions.
Please, please, please.
So let's take a break and come back and talk more about talk about that with Dr. Jonathan Metzl, professor of psychiatry and sociology at Vanderbilt University. We're taking your calls at 410-662-8780, your emails at midday@wypr.org. I'd love to hear whether you see some common sense solutions to this problem. I'm Sheila Cast. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cast. As more information about Sunday's mass shooting in Orlando, Florida emerges, we're looking at a factor that played a role in other incidents of mass violence, mental illness. We're also groping to find some common sense solutions. I'm speaking with Dr. Jonathan Metzl, professor of psychiatry and sociology at Vanderbilt University. He is also research director of an organization called the Safe Tennessee Project, an organization that views the issue of gun violence as a public health issue. You can be part of this conversation. I'd love to hear your suggestions for how the U.S. should address mass violence. 410-662-8780 is our phone number. Our email is midday@wypr.org. So, Dr. Metzl, I cut you off just as you were starting to talk about common sense solutions.
Well, I think, you know, I think about intervention in two ways. One is what we've been talking about to this point in the show, which is a question of prediction. In other words, were there warning signs in any particular case? Certainly in the Orlando case, it seems like there were warning signs. But more broadly, the point I was trying to make is that prediction is very hard just because you don't know who's going to go on to commit a violent act and who is not. Then the other half of the issue is prevention. In other words, can we set up kind of systems across this country that don't infringe on people's Second Amendment constitutional rights, but that prevent, you know, basically unnecessary death? And in the Safe Tennessee Project, for example, we're in a very red state, and we're trying to think of centrist positions, and we're increasingly garnering support, not by saying we're going to go out and take anybody's gun away, but I do think that there are common sense solutions particularly for people who might be at risk. And so one issue, for example, is what's called a gun violence restraining order, people who have had in the past some kind of partner violence, which seemed to be the case in the Orlando shooting, or other kinds of risk factors, might come under some kind of special review about firearm privileges. This isn't taking away anybody's guns, but it does seem to be a position where we can find some kind of middle ground about particularly identifying people who are at risk. I do think that there's a larger issue about assault rifles, and I'm glad that that question is being asked, because personally, I don't think that everybody in the country needs to have access to an assault rifle.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that. We had a call earlier from Linda, who couldn't stay with us. Linda in Phoenix said that as long as people can get their hands on assault rifles, she thinks these shootings will continue. She plans to write her representatives in Congress to encourage reinstating the ban on assault rifles that expired 12 years ago.
Right.
Do you include that in your common sense solutions?
Well, I certainly
because
think that
that is taking firearms away. That would be taking firearms away from some people.
Right. Well, I think that you know, it depends on how. In other words, I don't think we're going to drive to anybody's house and take away their gun. And that wasn't even the case in the ban previously. It was a ban on kind of the kinds of ways that we sell assault rifles. And I do think that there is a profound issue with that right now. And the reason I say that is because, for example, many states don't have background checks. There are many, many loopholes in the ways that people can obtain assault rifles. And I think that those loopholes really need to be closed. There are gun shows where you can easily get weapons like that. And so I think that in a way, there's no system for tracking. I mean, even in this country, we don't know how many AR-15s there are in circulation because we don't even have data. And there's a congressional ban on, for example, the CDC doing the kind of research to even track those firearms in the first place. And so I think that there are positions that we can take that look at this question, and particularly about issues like assault rifles, that again aren't a across the board ban. Some people need them for reasons about defense or things like that. But I would also say that to have a system like that where there's very minimal oversight, there are just far too many loopholes, and it's far too easy to get a weapon that really is the main purpose of a weapon like that is mass casualty.
But one of the discussions, the loop that tends to take place after a mass shooting has grabbed national attention is a discussion about should there be restrictions on guns, on who can get what kind of guns, and then that discussion goes to, well, of course there should be restrictions on people with a diagnosis of mental illness having access to weapons.
Right. Well, again, as I was saying before, I think that there are factors that we might want to pay attention to, and I certainly think that many of these factors are part of if we instituted national background checks the way that President Obama was suggesting, I think very smartly earlier this year in January, I do think that background checks are very, very effective and quick ways. Now, I don't think it would have stopped the Orlando shooting, unfortunately, but I think across the board, states that have a background check system look not just at questions of severe mental illness. There are other factors that I think are, again, just as important to pay attention to, the past history of violence being very high atop that list, questions of partner violence, and then just from a kind of everyday public health perspective, where people have guns. So, for example, alcohol and guns don't mix very well, and so having guns in places like bars, I think, is important to overlook. The questions of gun training, how much training can you get before getting a gun? And so, again, this is what I mean when I say common sense solutions, that I think that in a way, of course, mental illness is probably always going to be part of the conversation, and I'm at peace with that. But I would also say that there are many other factors that we need to look at, and that's why I think that really the background check system is not perfect, but it's the best system that we seem to have right now.
Our time grows short, but I want to talk to Laura, who has called us from Baltimore. Laura, welcome to Midday.
Hello.
Hello, Laura. You're on the air.
Hi, yes. My question to the doctor is, how much does he think the amount of violent video games, TV shows, movies, even football, the aggressive behavior that, you know, comes from, you know, watching extreme violence, what part does this play in the whole scheme of things?
Right. Well, that's a really good question. I think it's, in a way, my answer to that is similar to the question of mental illness, which is, if you just look at statistics, in other words, I mean, personally, I would say that I think that we do have an awful lot of violence in movies, and obviously video games are increasingly violent. But I don't think we've found predictive statistical correlations between people watching video games and then going out to kill people. And it's similar to what I was saying before about mental illness, which is that, again, even though I think video games are incredibly shockingly violent, I would also say that think about the number of people who watch video games, and it's a very, very small portion of those people who go out and then go out and harm somebody else. And in a way, some people might argue that video games allow people to act out those fantasies so that they don't do it in the real world. And so while I do think we need to have some kind of reform around how we're raising children in this country and how video games might fit into that, I would also say that it's similar to the position of the psychiatrist, which is to say, how are you going to pick which person of all the people who are watching video games is going to go on to commit a violent act? And in a way, I think that speaks to why I think mental illness and video games are, it's a community problem in a way. I don't think that, for example, psychiatrists need to be in the position of diagnosing who's going to go commit a violent act just because of the numbers game. I think we need to have a broader community conversation about violence in our society.
Laura, thanks for the call. John has called us from Baltimore. John, welcome to Midday.
How are you? I just call in with the idea of, people say common sense gun control is going to help solve the problem. But the problem is that the people that are making the laws don't necessarily understand. Right now, Maryland's assault weapon ban allows an AR-15 that has a heavy barrel. And the only difference between that and the banned version is the diameter of the barrel. Nothing about the rate of fire or anything changes.
John, I think we've lost you, and I'm not sure that I completely understand the point that John was raising. Except he seems to say there were already some good laws in place, but people don't follow them.
Well, and also there's just no uniformity in a way. That's why, I mean, it's been overlooked because it's hard to do anything in this country. But I think that President Obama really had some very important recommendations. I mean, in January, when he issued his executive order, about some kind of national uniformity about the ways that we sell guns and the way that we flag high-volume sellers, the way that we use background checks. And part of the issue is that our gun laws now are such a patchwork. So you can have a state or a county that has very strict regulations about gun control, but then the next state over, like if you think about Chicago, if you're in Chicago, very strict gun laws, you can just drive to Wisconsin or Indiana, load up your car with guns, and then go back. And so in a way, it's the lack of uniformity, I think, that gets people into trouble about gun laws. And in a way, they're just, as I mentioned before, there are too many loopholes. Let me just say one other point, which is when we say common sense solutions, the point is that we're a very polarized society. Many people feel very strongly about this issue on all sides. And I think that in a way, when I hear people say, we're just going to go take away people's guns, I think that that's a really real perversion of what I think needs to happen moving forward. I think that there is a lot of respect for the Second Amendment. But I also think that there needs to be a conversation about some kind of coming together, some kind of centrist position in which we say we respect people's right to own firearms, but we also need some kind of system to prevent the kinds of killing that we're seeing.
You mentioned state laws, and I understand you've studied how gun laws, when they were relaxed in Missouri, affected people's interactions.
Right. Yeah, I just wrote a piece actually about that, and it was really in part there's a lot of data that precedes me even from Johns Hopkins. We heard a researcher from there previously. I'm looking at what happened in the aftermath of when Missouri relaxed its made it basically easier for people to buy a gun without a permit. And certainly, I think that the data is very solid in this regard, that the easier it is to get guns, the more gun crime you're going to have. In the piece that I just published in the New Republic, I also looked at how, beyond questions of death, having a lot of guns around changed the ways that people interact with each other. So when there's not a shooting, it doesn't make it to the news. And I went around and just asked everyday people, how is it that seeing somebody with a gun or carrying a gun, how does that change how you interact with people? And I think it was causing a lot of very different kinds of anxieties for people who were avoiding situations, not because they thought they were going to get shot, but because they were worried that people were just toting guns around without any training or any concern.
So they were worried about getting shot.
Well, I think they were worried in part about that, but I think it was also about intimidation.
We have just a minute or so left, and for people who are listening to and watching coverage about the recent shooting and feeling upset or worried about future shootings, do you have any words of advice or any suggestion for how they should be processing this?
Well, these are moments of awakening for all of us. I think that there are moments where I think it's not just grieving the victims. That's so important. It's so important. But it's also moments of self-reflection. I mean, I think that in a way the caller before was right, that as much as we want to say this is a problem from outside, we need to close the borders, that's really the wrong lesson. This is a moment of self-reflection. This is a homegrown issue. And so the question is, at this moment, how can we reflect in a way that makes us, you know, self-aware in a way? How can we use these moments? And I think what's sad about our kind of predetermined responses to mass shootings is that they become these moments of polarization in which people say, I'm for guns, I'm against guns. And I think really at these moments of trauma, in addition to coming together and mourning, we also need to come together and think about how can we forge some kind of middle ground that helps us move forward.
I really appreciate this conversation. Thank you.
Thank you so much, yes.
Jonathan Metzl is professor of psychiatry and sociology at Vanderbilt University. He's director of the school's Center for Medicine, Health, and Society, and he's research director for the Safe Tennessee Project, an organization that advocates for common sense measures to reduce gun injuries and death. I'd also like to thank Joe Squared for providing lunch for Midday Today. Joe Squared serves coal-fired pizzas, risotto, local craft beers, locations, and hours at joesquared.com. And thank you for listening. Tomorrow, Uber, Lyft, TaskRabbit. These apps are part of the emerging gig economy. What does it all mean for the future of work in America? Join us tomorrow for that. I'm Sheila Cast. Have a great afternoon.
Midday is produced by Maureen Harvey and Andrea Appleton. The show is engineered by Luke Spicknall. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcasts and live streaming are available at wypr.org or on demand using the WYPR app. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.